Thank you so much. Good afternoon and welcome to the talk. So the aim of this talk is to tell you about a very nice underlying structure, geometric structure, which basically underlies black holes in four dimensions, but also in any number of dimensions. So if you go to higher dimensions, this geometric structure actually is still there. So I had in the title hidden symmetries. So in the introduction, I will try to tell you what I mean by hidden symmetries, and I'll try to give you a precise definition. Of course, this term is used in other fields and in other aspects as well, but so that's why I have to specify what I mean by hidden symmetries in terms of the black holes. Then I will switch to K geometry and then show you that really K geometry can be characterized and has this beautiful geometric structure encoded in principal Killing-Yano tensor. And then once I introduce this principal Killing-Yano tensor, there will be a little bit of mass, but you will see that the structure is really beautiful. Then I will talk about particles and fields in black hole spacetimes in any number of dimensions. And so there are some friends who participated in this research. And so I have been working on this for more than 10 years. So actually, there's lots of people involved here. All right. So what I mean by hidden symmetries. So let me start with the central force problem. So you have just the central force, and you know that the problem is static, so there is the conserved energy, and also it's spherically symmetric, so there is a conserved angular momentum. So you obviously have four constants of motion. However, if you specify to very special central force, which is given by 1 over r squared, the most physically interesting one, the Kepler problem, then actually suddenly a new symmetry appears, and this guy by this Laplace Rangelands vector. So it's a new vector, it's a conserved quantity, so we have three extra conserved quantities, and they are given by P cross L plus some correction in R direction. This thing has very nice geometrical meaning, so if you consider your trajectory around the sun or whatever, and then you draw P cross L and MK times R, it's this vector here. So then you find that you find this vector here. So next you look at a different point in the trajectory and you see that this combination again gives you the same vector. So it's the vector which is always pointing in that direction and remains a constant of motion. Okay. But you immediately see that this symmetry actually is connected with the motion. So only if I know how my planet evolves around the sun, only then I know that there is this conserved quantity A. However, there is no geometrical structure in the configuration space of your three manifold, which would tell you that there is this conserved quantity A. Okay, and so this is basically what I mean by hidden symmetries. So this Laplace-Rungelands vector is a dynamical symmetry. I will define it in a minute. But there is no corresponding transformation of the space, which would leave my space invariant, and which would lead to the conserved quantity A through the normal Noether's theorem. So by the way, this motion, it makes the Kepler motion completely superintegrable. So you have now 3 degrees of freedom. So you need three constants of motion. Here you have one, here you have three, and here you have another three. So apparently you have 7. However, there is some non-trivial relation between them. So 2 equations kill 2 integrals of motion. So you have 5 constants of motion which are independent. And that's 2 times d, if you have d number of degrees of freedom, minus 1, which is the maximum number you can ever have. The last one would be basically the choice of initial time. So you would have 6. Okay, so now what I mean by dynamical symmetries. So let me just briefly review these Hamiltonian dynamics. So you start with the symplectic manifold, and so symplectic manifold is equipped with the non-degenerate closed two form omega. And so having this two form, you can define the corresponding symplectic gradient or Hamiltonian vector flow. So given a phase space function f, I just take its gradient, multiply by omega, and I have a corresponding vector field. You can also use the fact that you have non-degenerate closed two form, and that means that I can actually introduce some very special coordinates in which my symplectic 2 form has a nice form, and it's precisely this one. So you introduce, so these are the coordinates on your symplectic manifold, but you can call them x mu and p nu, and such that your symplectic 2 form actually is written as dp mu dx mu. And these are called Darboux coordinates. So next, there's this beautiful Noether's theorem in the phase space, which is slightly more general than the standard one which you actually learned about in the first year at the university. So let Hamiltonian be preserved by an infinitesimal transformation, delta x mu, delta p nu. Then there exists a conserved quantity q, such that, well, it is conserved, so it commutes with the Hamiltonian. And so this is the corresponding Hamiltonian vector flow corresponding to the symmetry. So now why is this more general than the standard one which you learn about in Lagrangian mechanics? It's because of this thing here. So specifically, this was true for any symplectic manifold, but now we can consider a phase space. And so phase space is a cotangent bundle over the manifold, also P star M. And so phase space is equipped with some extra structure, and that's a canonical projection. So there is a map which maps whatever happens on the phase space to the manifold. And that doesn't exist for general symplectic manifold. It only happens if you have this T star of M. Okay. So now you can use this map to actually distinguish two types of symmetries. So you take your conserved quantity Q, calculate the corresponding vector flow XQ, and you make the projection. So this is just an induced map from this canonical projection. And so you find two possibilities. Either if you do this, you get a vector field on your manifold M, and then you get an isometry, or you don't get a vector field on the manifold M, and this is called the dynamical symmetry. Okay, so this is the definition of what we mean by dynamical symmetry. And here is the example. So we have this Laplace-Runge lens vector. I just wrote it in Cartesian coordinates. And so you take that quantity A, and you calculate the corresponding vector field, XA. And so here's the result. And you see that it has two parts, one in the X direction, and the second one in the P direction. Okay. So now, if you now make this canonical projection down to the manifold, of course, it kills this P direction. And so what I recover is just this first part. And if you look at it, this first part, you better get a nice vector field on the manifold, but you don't get it because this still depends on P. So because this still depends on P, this is not a vector field on manifold M. Okay, manifold M can only have X things. So this is a dynamical symmetry. Okay. Very nice. So now we can play the same game, but now in general relativity. And so let me consider a very special case of particle motion. So here's the Hamiltonian, and of course, it gives the geodesic equation p mu, nabla mu p nu equals to zero. So now you can look at linear in momentum conserved quantities. So I consider a quantity, which, k mu, p mu, where k mu is some vector field. And this is my momentum. And so then the statement is, this quantity will be a conserved quantity for any geodesic, provided that this vector field k nu satisfies Killing vector equation. Of course, the proof is the one everybody does in the first introduction to general relativity. So I just take a dot, meaning I transport this quantity ck along the geodesic. And so I get two terms using the Leibniz rule. So first, I differentiate k mu. But I have p nu, p mu here. And so this is symmetric, so I can freely symmetrize here. And so that's the first term. And then the second term, of course, I'm using the geodesic equation here. And so this automatically vanishes. So in order this to be true for any geodesic, I have to have nabla nu k mu equals to zero. So that's how you derive Killing vector equation. And so Killing vectors are in one-to-one correspondence with conserved quantities which are linear in particle moment. Okay, so now you can calculate. So now you take this quantity ck and calculate the corresponding vector flow, xck. And so what you find is, again, two terms, one in the x direction, one in the p direction. Now I make the canonical projection. So I kill this part here. and you recover back your killing vector field. Okay, so this is a nice vector field on the manifold, and that's why this is an isometric. Okay. So now you can play the same game. Yes?
It's just a small question. Here it's literally an isometry.
Yeah.
So if you go back to the other case, from the Quinte vector, it's not, you don't mean literally an isometry, do you?
It's just a terminology.
Generalized symmetry.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's just a terminology. But here it's literally what you would expect. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just misusing the term from general relativity, basically. All right, so now you can look at the high order concept quantity. So now instead of linear, I consider there is p possible momenta. And so I have a tensor which is without loss of generality symmetric in p indices. And the statement, this will be, again, a concept quantity for any geodesic, provided this equation is satisfied. And the proof goes exactly the same way as you've seen for a Killing vector. So now this object is called Killing tensor. And so you recover the Killing tensor equation. This is actually known for some quite time. Actually, it was introduced in mathematics in 1895, but to physics in 1970 by Walker and Penrose. Okay, so now you can construct the corresponding vector field and make the projection. So I kill the p part, and what you see is this thing here. Again, this quantity here is not a nice vector on the manifold, and that's why this is a dynamical symmetry. It's not a configuration symmetry. Another dynamical symmetry actually is a slight generalization of this. So maybe I don't want just a constant which is parallel transported along the geodesic. But maybe I want the whole vector, which is parallel transported along the geodesic. So now I take a new tensor, fv nu, p nu, and I require that this vector be better orthogonal to my p direction. Why not? So I require that, and that immediately tells you that this fv nu will be antisymmetric in these two indices. And then you require that this vector is parallel transported. And so it translates into the following equation here, which is almost like this, but now you have antisymmetric object, and you can symmetrize only over two indices. And this is the Killing-Yano equation. And it was introduced in mass in 1952 by Yano, and then to physics by Penrose in 1973. Okay, so this is another dynamical symmetry which you can have in space-time. So now I will call whatever the explicit symmetries given by Killing vectors, well, the symmetries described by Killing vectors, the explicit symmetries, and the symmetries given by Killing tensors and Killing-Yano tensors by hidden symmetries in the space-time. And so let me just note that actually, if you have Killing-Yano tensor, you can always construct a Killing tensor by squaring it. So I take a square of fp nu, I construct over one index here, and I get a Killing tensor. The other way, it doesn't work. So some Killing tensors can be written as a square root of f mu nu, but not all of them. Okay, so now I introduce all these objects by just basically considering the particle motion. However, as we shall see, these symmetries are important for other things as well. And so, for example, for dynamics of the fields in the spacetimes. Okay, so here we go. So chaos geometry, everybody knows it. It's a unique solution of Einstein equations describing a rotating black hole. It was constructed by Kerr in 1963. And so it's actually 4 years before even the term black hole existed. Okay. And so it's described by simply two parameters, by mass and rotation. And so provided the cosmic censorship is true, although people try to violate it now, especially in ADS and in higher dimensions and so on, it is a final configuration of gravitational collapse, and so it should be generic in our universe.
That's a conjecture. We don't know.
Sure.
Conjecture
of a
conjecture.
Good. So now chaos geometry has many remarkable properties, and as we shall see, they are precisely related to this Killing-Yano tensor. So first of them, which was discovered by Carter, is that the geodesic motion is completely integrable. So what does it mean? So you are in four space-time dimensions, so you need to integrate the geodesic motion, you need four constants of motion. So you have two isometries, dt, d phi, stationary and axisymmetric. And so you have the conserved energy and conserved angular momentum in one direction. Of course, you always get the normalization of the four velocity. So that's only three integrals of motion. So surprise, surprise, there is a fourth one, and it's precisely given by this Killing tensor and discovered by Carter in 1968. So you can show that these four are independent and make the geodesic motion integrable. Even more interesting is the fact that actually you can study test fields in the Kerr geometry. And so these field equations typically decouple and separate. So for example, this applies to scale field, Dirac electromagnetic and gravitational perturbations. And so the first result is due to Carter in 1968. And then perhaps most interesting is Tokolsky, 1972, who considered particles with spin, so electromagnetic and gravitational perturbations. And so then the Dirac equation was done by Chandrasekhar and Page. And then Walls showed how actually to use Tokolsky results to recover everything. And so, of course, once you transform your partial differential equations to ordinary differential equations, everything becomes much simpler, and you can actually study lots of physics problems which happen around the black holes. Another miracle, if you want, is that you can write the Kerr geometry in so-called Kerr-Shield form. And so the Kerr-Shield form, and I will talk about a little bit later today, is that your full metric, the full nonlinear solution of Einstein equations, is given by the flat metric, so this is just the flat spacetime, plus a linear in mass perturbation, and this is some null vector which doesn't depend on the parameters. So the only appearance of the mass, which makes the spacetime non-flat, is actually in this term, and it's a linear in mass perturbation of flat spacetime. Finally, the metric actually is of the special algebraic type. So the Weyl tensor is very, very special. And this is how Kerr actually found it. So Kerr played with these algebraic with special solutions, and he found many of them. And one of them happens to be Kerr and interesting. Okay. So now here comes the central hero. The statement is that all these properties can be actually attributed to the existence of a single object, which is this principal tensor. So now what it is a non-degenerate closed conformal Killingiano 2 form. I will explain what it means. But basically, it means that it satisfies this equation. So take a 2 form, HAB, so antisymmetric object, take its covariant derivative. And of course, for a normal object, this will be this is an object which depends on many components. But for a closed conformal Killingiano 2 form, this is simply given by a vector psi. And so all you need to know about the derivative of this object is this vector psi.
Is it general vector or is it time like?
Sorry?
What type of properties would you assign to the vector?
So you will see soon that by tracing this equation, you find that psi is just a divergence of H. And what I will also show that in any Einstein space, this has to be a Killing vector. So it is a very special vector. Why all the above properties are actually attributed to this? Well, for example, the Carter's constant, where we saw this Killing tensor, is basically you get this Killing tensor by squaring this object here. So it's not precisely the Killingiano tensor, it's a little bit more complicated. You have this H square here as well. So this HAB is a dual, Hodge dual of the standard Killingiano tensor people use. Also, if you look at this equation and study its integrability conditions, you find that actually, the Weyl tensor has to be of the type T, so for example. And you can go from here, and so you can show all the properties I have mentioned just from the existence of this object. All right, so now what is my talk about is what happens in higher dimensions. Okay, so there is, people are interested in higher dimensions, and so motivations come from string theory and brainwashed scenarios, and people are interested how general relativity works in higher dimensions, whether there's something special about four dimensions and so on. And so we may look at the direct generalization of the Kerr metric to the number of dimensions, and that's described by Myers' perimetric in 1986. And so here are the two gentlemen who discovered this metric. And so it's not precisely the Kerr metric. It's a little bit more complicated, because if you start adding extra number of dimensions, you start adding a possibility that actually your black hole can rotate in another independent two-plane. So basically, you should be thinking about rotation as a rotation in a two-plane rather than a rotation around the axis. So for any two independent two-planes, I have one rotation, and then I have another rotation here, and so on. In fact, I will do actually slightly more general metric than this one. I will also add the nut charges and the cosmological constant. And so the results which I will discuss here are actually valid in any number of dimensions greater than 3. All right, so now I already introduced the principle of Killingano tensor, so let me talk about it a little bit more, what it actually means. Okay, so take a general differential P form, omega, and take its covariant derivative. Okay, so then you can show that there is an invariant splitting into three parts, into the exterior, divergent, and harmonic parts. So general derivative will have all three, and they are orthogonal. So now, if one of the parts actually is missing, then you get something special. So for example, if the exterior and divergent part is missing, you have a harmonic form. And of course, they are of interest. I will actually consider the precise opposite. I will consider an object which doesn't have this harmonic part. So it has only exterior and divergent part. If that is true, your object is special, and it's called conformal Killingano tensor. So what I mean by exterior part, so you take the covariant derivative, and it's given only by the exterior derivative. And the divergence part, this is just divergence of that object. Okay, so this is a strange notation. Sorry for that. I'll write it in components very soon. Okay, so now, if one more part is missing, then this object is even more special. So this is the conformal Killingano tensor. Now, if the divergence part is missing, so this guy is not here, you get a Killingano tensor without the name conformal. And if this part is missing, you get a closed conformal Killingano tensor.
Is this this description gives you something. Is it a Killingano tensor or a closed conformal Killingano tensor? But is it the case that any closed, say, conformal Killingano tensor is invariably described as well?
And so what is nice about these two, yeah?
This is a purely algebraic decomposition locally? Or I'm just asking.
It's purely algebraic, if you want.
Purely algebraic.
Yeah. So I can split the space of T1, P, or whatever, yeah.
Often harmonic, it looked purely algebraic here.
Yeah.
Often harmonic has to do with the boundary conditions.
I'm not imposing any of this. No, it's just about, So now, why these two subtleties are interesting is that actually they behave very nicely under the Hodge duality. So if I take a Hodge dual of closed conformal Killingano tensor, I get Killingano tensor, and vice versa. Okay, so they behave nicely under this Hodge duality. All right, so now if I specify and again define this principle Killingano tensor, so it's a two form, and it's a closed conformal Killingano two form, so it has only so it is closed. It's closed and satisfies this equation, the simplest equation here. And it has only this divergence part. So this psi vector, which I wrote before, is now obvious. It's a divergent piece of each. So this is just the defining equation of a closed conformal Killingano two form. And you can show that this psi actually is a divergent by tracing the equation, and it is closed, as you would expect. So now what I will also require is that this two form is non-degenerate, meaning that it has the full matrix rank. So if in 2n dimensions, it has the full number of eigenvalues. And so these eigenvalues, I will use them as coordinates later on. All right. So now let me turn to these higher dimensional Kernot ADS spacetimes in all dimensions. And so it was actually shown that precisely this object exists in all these spacetimes. It was many, many years ago. And then later on, it was shown that actually these are the only spacetimes which admit this object. So So that was proved this uniqueness theorem that the most general solution of vacuum Einstein equations that admit this principal Killingano tensor is the Kernot ADS spacetime in any number of dimensions. And it was shown in these two papers here. So now, what are we talking about? Let me just flash the metric here. So the metric will have two types of coordinates. It will have the Killing coordinates psi, and it will have the non-trivial coordinates x mu. Okay.
Can I interrupt David for just 1 second? Was there any prior statement about those? So if you take the Kernot ADS, was there some previous statement that they were the most general metrics with such and such a property, or is this the kind of now the most natural characterization of that class of metrics?
I don't precisely understand the question, but we first discovered that it exists.
Before you had proven that result, that you have this set of exact solutions, the Kerr, not ADS metrics. Before you had proven that result, would you have been able to say these are the most general metrics with such and such a generic, some such and such a property?
So how it went is that first these space times were constructed, and we found there's this object, and then we started from the object and started constructing the most general spacetime and we arrived at the same spacetime.
Right. So now you have kind of a nice property that these are the most general solutions that property.
That's right.
I was asking whether there was any previously known property like that, or apart from that they were just found as a class, were they the most general metrics with any other? I'm just wondering whether there's any other property that now turns out to be equivalent to that property, or is it just...
I think this is like a new property which wasn't really known, and.
Let me ask you a related question. So if I think of, let's say, ADS, where 5, 6 dimensions, and it fixes the charges as you told it, it's in mass and angular momentum, I don't have anything.
Okay.
As opposed to the case in 4 dimensions, what I do. Do you think you can use these to determine the difference, or just have a uniqueness? If you add some condition, the Killingano tensor, that will kind of give you care, as opposed to a black sample.
I suppose you could, Certainly, you know, this really distinguishes these space times. No other space times can have that.
Because what we always thought that maybe if you add an extra requirement, that the space time has to be stable, that would pick a unique solution. Because all the arguments would be unstable.
Yeah, unstable, yeah.
And you can establish something about the Killingano for uniqueness, maybe also the
C. It implies the stability.
Stability.
That would be nice, yeah. That would be very nice. All right, so I'll hide this for a minute. So basically, how the construction goes is that, well, it went in the Euclidean signature, and that's a little bit catchy. So I will talk about it in the afternoon a little bit more. So anyway, so you can always diagonalize a metric. So you write it in orthonormal form. And then what is actually beautiful is that you can also skew diagonalize your two form. It's something like a Darboux theorem. So now these things are sort of like an eigenvalues of this two form. epsilon is 0 for even dimensions and 1 for all dimensions. And so you start playing with this metric, and then you start writing your integrability conditions for the principal tensor. And in the end, what you find is this metric here. So these orthonormal frames are simply given by these strange quantities here. But if you look at them, they are all something like very nice polynomials or very nice symmetric things in terms of these non-trivial coordinates, x1, 2, xn. So there's n of those, and so then you have these polynomials here. And so you form everything in terms of these polynomials. And then you have the orthogonal coordinates here. And so the statement is the general metric has, so there's also these metric functions x mu. And so the general metric will have these general functions, just functions of x mu. If you impose in addition Einstein equations, these metric functions actually become nice polynomials in this function x mu. Okay, so this is the metric. I just wanted to flash it. It's not very, it definitely includes the Kerr metric in 4 dimensions. And you know, everything simplifies there. But it's basically in 4 dimensions, this is the Carter's form of the Kerr geometry. It's not the Boyle-Lindquist form, it's the Carter's form.
What is the range of J?
So as I said, so you have, you parameterize the D number of dimensions as 2n plus epsilon, epsilon 0 or 1. And so these x mu coordinates, they go from 1 to n, basically how many eigenvalues of your 2 form you can have. And so in 2n dimensions, you can have only n, and then there is the conjugate 1. All right. And so these psi's, so they go to D. So there's either n of them or n plus 1 of them, depending on. So you have to have.
So the x mu's are not a complete coordinate system.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you have to have these psi's as well. All right. So now, why this may be true is this.
Just in the 4 dimensions, what are the x's and what are the psi's?
Oh, very good. So you would have 2 x's in 4 dimensions and 2 psi's. So one x is r, the other x is theta, or cosine theta, or something like that. And then you have tau and
psi's are kind of the ones associated with the symmetry.
Exactly. All right, so why this works is that you get from that one simple object H, you get the whole tower of symmetries. And why you get that is this beautiful lemma here, is that if you have 2 closed conformal Killingenau tensors, K1 and K2, and take their exterior product, then you also get a closed conformal Killingenau tensor. You can show that in one line, although nobody did before us. It's interesting. So what it means is that if I have one H, I can wedge it many times. I can make an exterior product as many times as I want. Of course, it eventually terminates. But I get these non-trivial objects, HJ, which, of course, of increasing rank, which are, again, closed conformal Killingenau tensors. You can take the Hodge tool. You get Killingenau tensors. And you can square these Killingenau tensors to get Killing tensors AAB. So just starting with one H, you have the whole tower of these HJ, FJ, and Killing tensors. But that's not everything. You can do even more. You can actually construct all these Killing vectors. And so how it goes is precisely you can show that this psi, which I mentioned in the definition of H, which is divergence of H, has to be a Killing vector. You can show that. It's very, very non-trivial. If you start building the metric, take several pages to actually show that this psi has to be a Killing vector. If you are in Einstein space, it comes immediately at you. If you are not, then it's very difficult to show. But once you show that, you can always construct these Killing tensors with psi and construct additional Killing vectors. And so this is easy to show. Once you know that psi is a Killing vector, you can construct all these Killing vectors. So now you have the whole tower of explicit symmetries and the whole tower of hidden symmetries, and because they are all constructed from one object, you can show that actually they all mutually commute. And that's a very nice property to have. So this is basically like a Lie bracket of 2 vectors, and this is a Lie bracket of vector with respect to a tensor, and this is, if you want, generalized Lie bracket, which is called Chowton-Nienschulz bracket, and it gives you that. So all these objects actually mutually commute.
Does this last one have a geometric meaning that you can say?
I will use it for integrability of geodesics. So if you return back, this is what you need precisely for this to give you the right constants of motion. This bracket, so if you take symmetric tensors and you want to study their algebra, then they form an algebra with respect to this bracket here. So it's precisely this bracket. Of course, it's increasing rank, so it doesn't close. The algebra doesn't close. You in general produce, so if you take rank 2, you produce rank 3, and so on. So it doesn't close, but it's nice.
You can't associate it with some transformation. In the case of the 2 vectors, we know what it means for their Lie bracket to vanish.
I don't know if there is any geometrical meaning to this one.
Something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably not. All right, so we suffered through the mass. So now let's use it for something interesting. And so first thing, you can look at the geodesic motion. So you look at the particles and light. And so here's the definition. I basically use it already, but anyway. So if you have d-dimensional manifold, so d number of degrees of freedom, and you study the motion, then you have to find d functional independent integrals of motion that are in involution, meaning that they all mutually possibly commute one of another. Okay, so that's the definition which you find in Arnold or other books. So now here we go. So we have n or n plus 1 explicit symmetries, and so these are the concept quantities corresponding to Killing vectors. And then you have n Killing tensors, and you construct these concept quantities here. So together you have d integrals of motion. Of course, what you have to show is that they are functionally independent and that they mutually Poisson commute, but the Poisson commutation precisely corresponds to this computation of these objects here. Okay, so it was shown here, and indeed, in any number of dimensions, the geodesic motion around arbitrary rotating black holes is actually integrable. And so mathematicians may be happy, because you get infinite number of systems which are completely integrable for each dimension one.
Didn't you just answer the question? You're saying it has a geometric meaning in phase space, but not necessarily back in the original space.
Yeah. That's what I meant. Yeah.
So it preserves what? So the killing vector is generating isometry on the actual manifold. What the higher rank?
They just correspond to some symmetry in the phase space. But if you project it down, you don't get anything nice.
Symmetry in the sense that they preserve what?
They preserve the Hamiltonian. So you find such a transformation which preserves the Hamiltonian, but in general the transformation mixes p's and x's and whatever, and if you project it down, you don't.
But you also said their Poisson brackets vanish or something like that, I think, right?
Here.
That's some statement about the vector fields in the phase space mesh or whatever, they form surfaces.
Exactly.
They commute.
I have a related question about the physics of this. So in Kerr, when you get the principal null geodesics, in general, they just form a threading. They don't form a hypersurface or orthogonal congruence.
Okay.
But by using the Carter constant, Pretorius and Israel showed really nicely that you can adjust that congruence in such a way to make it hypersurface orthogonal.
Okay.
And so you can actually build light cones for Kerr that were sort of non-obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious if these results lead to light cones in these other space times in a trivial way.
I don't know.
Okay.
But certainly, you know, because you have all these constants, so you can foliate your thing with the hypersurfaces, and you can restrict your motion into those, you know, submanifolds and stuff like that. Yeah. Right, so now you can also separate the scalar perturbations. So you can study the massive Klein-Bodron equation. And so what people thought is that, well, the first result in 5D is basically the same as what Carter did. So it's a slight generalization of Carter's result for the space-times. When people wanted to go to higher dimensions, actually, they did not really succeed. The reason was that they were still using the coordinates which Myers and Perry wrote down. And these are not very nice coordinates. The reason is that they are actually constrained. So you have these coordinates, you have the radial coordinate r, and then you have the coordinates mu. But the coordinates mu are something like cosines and sines and whatever. And so they have to, in the end, obey a condition that cosine squared plus sine squared is equal to 1. And so there's this constraint always lurking at you. And so that's why they are not nice coordinates. And so people only succeeded partially, is that they had to enhance the symmetry of the spacetime by assuming that the spacetime is special rotating, and if the spacetime is special rotating, you get extra Killing vectors. Okay, and so people thought, well, maybe this is as general as we can do. However, using the new coordinates, these canonical coordinates dictated by your Killing tensor, these coordinates x mu, actually they are not constrained; they are very nice coordinates, and the metric is sort of diagonal in them. Well, not really, but so we were able to separate that. But to actually do that, there were some tricks. So first of all, as I said, separation only occurs in these canonical coordinates, not the Myers-Perry coordinates. Separation is a property of coordinates. It may happen in one coordinate and not in the other. We had to pull out some miraculous identities out of the hat. And most importantly, like a more involved separation of variables is actually needed. So typically, when people separate variables in physics, they find the relation, I have a sum of f nu, where f nu depends only on one coordinate. And so this is what you find. And then, of course, you know that f nu has to be equal to a constant, and some of these constants have to be equal to 0. This is the standard separation of variables people use. So here, you find something a little bit slightly more difficult. You have now a sum of f nu divided by u nu, where this u nu is this horrible product of various x nu. So it's x1 minus x2 square, x2, x3 minus x2 square, and so on. And so you can show that actually, if this is true, then these f nu's are not simply given by constant, but they are given by polynomials. And polynomials with these coefficients, and these coefficients are precisely the separation constants. Okay? And so if you use this trick, and so you can just prove it by Mathematica or whatever. You now impose an ansatz, the standard separability ansatz for your scale field, and use this property, and you find some nice ODEs for these functions R mu, which are functions of one variable only. So you transform your problem of Klein-Gordon equation, which is, of course, partial differential equation, to a set of ODEs for these functions R mu.
Another quick question. In the case of the mechanical system, like the Kepler one you gave, you can show that if it's superintegrable, it's multi-separable. You can separate it more than one coordinate system. Do you have a result like that here?
I have no idea in which coordinate system this separates. It does separate in these, but So we have only integrable. We don't have superintegrable. So yeah, I don't know. So the big question was, why does this work? And so why it works is because one can find a complete set of mutually commuting operators. This is like doing quantum mechanics, right? One of which is the Klein-Gordon operator with common eigenfunctions is the separated solution. Okay, and these eigenvalues correspond to separated constants. So more specifically, you can actually take your Killing tensors, AAB, and construct second order operators out of them. This should be nabla A, nabla B. You have second order operator here. And so that gives you some second order operators. And then you have your Killing vectors here, and there's another operators. So of course, K0 here is just a box, the Klein-Gordon operator, if you want. And then you can show that all these things actually mutually commute in sense of the operators. OK, so these conditions are stronger than the conditions that these guys actually commute. OK, so you get, in the leading order, you need that the Killing tensors commute with the Killing vectors, but you get some extra anomalous conditions, and they are satisfied. So these requirements that the operators commute are stronger than what we needed for particle motion. But anyway, so once you have that, you know that you can search for common eigenfunctions, which are just eigenfunctions of these operators. And these are the corresponding eigenvalues. And they are precisely the separation constants in your solution. It's like quantum mechanics. Okay, so really, you know, this thing can be derived by looking at the complete set of operators. Interestingly, you can play the same game for the Dirac equation. I will not go to the details, but here's your massive Dirac equation. And then you can put a separation ansatz. So there's, again, the explicit coordinates, and there's these products of small spinners, which each depends only on one coordinate, x nu. But there's also this stupid prefactor R, which actually I don't know how to really derive. It has to be, you know, by trial. You have to find it. And so that's why it's called R-separable form, because there is this prefactor which is not separable. And you have to find that prefactor. Now you can actually show that this works again, because you can find the corresponding operators, which all mutually commute, and one of which is the Dirac operator. And so these operators, in this case, so in the case time Gordon equation, they were constructed out of the Killing tensors and Killing vectors. In this case, this should be else. So these operators are constructed from the Killing vectors, and these operators are constructed from the powers of the principles. So these are the closed, there are beautiful results about Killing Gano tensors and separability of Dirac fields. I have no time to. So now, the most recent results, you can actually also show separability of Maxwell fields in all these things. So here are the Maxwell equations, which I have to satisfy. And so in four dimensions, and what people tried in high dimensions as well, is to use the Newman-Penrose formalism. So basically, you take your field strength FAB, and you project it on some frame, and then you study some components, and so hopefully these components decouple, and then one of the components actually does separate. Okay, and so people tried in higher dimensions the same approach, that is a higher dimensional generalization of Newman-Penrose formalism, but actually it doesn't work, and only partial results actually were obtained. So for example, this result for near horizon geometry. So if you have very, very special case of your black hole space times. So now breakthrough actually happened last year, not by me, but by Oleg Lunin. And so he actually came with a completely new separation ansatz. And he said, well, forget about Newman-Penrose formalism, forget about field strength. Let's look at the vector potential A. And so he was looking at this vector potential, and he showed that actually, if I make the following ansatz for the vector potential, it's basically a gradient of some scalar function, but there's some tensor which modifies this gradient, VAB. Okay, and so then what he showed is that if you plug it into the Maxwell equations and take this separation ansatz as you would do for, but now for the scalar function, actually you can separate all your equations, and it works. So now what we've shown is that this prefactor in this case actually has very nice interpretation of this in terms of this principal tensor. So this BAB is basically an inverse of a linear combination of the metric plus I times the principal tensor. So it's so BAB is an inverse of this. Okay, so that's how you find this BAB in general spacetime. And also what we've shown is actually that you can write down the equations, the Maxwell equations give you some equations for this set. And you can show that similar equations can be, similar operators can be also constructed. Again, they will be all mutually commuting, one of which will be this operator which you need, the Maxwell equation. And you can show that the separation constants are, again, the eigenfunctions, eigenvalues of these operators. So now, before Lewis disappears, the most recent result, and probably the most interesting for you, Lewis, is that you can do it for massive vector field as well. And this is something people didn't know that it works even in four dimensions. But yes, you can separate using the same ansatz, you can separate Broca equations. And so here are the results in collaboration with George Santos. And so you can study the quasi-normal modes using the separated equations for the massive Broca equation. So what you would expect is that massive vector field has three polarizations in four dimensions. We only discovered two by the separation ansatz. So it's an open question whether the third one is hiding somewhere in our separation ansatz or whether we actually have to do something new. So George wasn't able to find it. But anyway, so we could discover two things, and precisely the same separation ansatz as this one works for this massive vector field. And of course, people are excited recently about these things because it describes superradiant instability due to ultralight massive effect particles.
And the results you get are in agreement with the results by Masha.
Exactly. So what the analytic predictions actually they could so they only studied the most unstable mode, so this one. And so they were able to basically do the prediction in this regime. So then there is a work by Cardoso, which they could only do prediction in that regime. And now with our ODEs, we can do in every regime. Also, because in this paper, they studied the full PDEs. George told me that it took a month to actually produce this picture. And they couldn't really get into these small values. So here, with ODEs, it takes overnight. So I think this is the most interesting result now.
How could you only have two polarizations?
Ah, very good. So these two polarizations are captured by this separation ansatz as long as we know it. So of course, this separation ansatz was primarily done for the Maxwell field, right? So
Z of the Z particle at the LHC has 3 degrees of polarization. Has two, because of the Higgs symmetry.
No. So this has nothing to do with this Higgs, right? This is the massive vector field, and I agree there should be three polarizations. There has to be three polarizations. I agree with that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying we were able to, at this point, only extract two. We were not able to, at this point,
there must be something wrong with it.
Find the third one. No. It simply may be the case is that the third polarization cannot be described in this ansatz, right? So this ansatz is something very, very special. I'm looking for a solution which looks like this. And maybe the third polarization, you need something else. Or maybe you are not looking hard enough numerically.
He's not saying the third polarization doesn't exist, John. He's just saying he hasn't found the analytic solution for it.
Yeah, I'm just saying I couldn't find it yet.
Well, you'd better keep looking.
Sure.
In your Maxwell equation, if you go back to the Maxwell case, you're looking for complex solutions?
Everything here is in general.
The procedure requires you to look for complex ones for some reason.
Yeah. Everything here is complex. So even this new here, we thought originally that it has to be real, but actually it's like another separation constant, which in general is complex. Yeah.
Does this happen in 4D too?
Yes. Yeah, you can reproduce the 4D results with this.
No, I mean, when people separated it in 4D curve, let's say, the Maxwell equations, did they have to introduce some complex ansatz like this?
That's a good question. I would say in general it's complex, but...
Could you remind me what the interpretation of mu is? What is...
Okay, so that's it's simply something, it's some complex parameter. So when we were producing these things here, plotting these things here. So what you do is that you have separated equations for this function z, and this z depends on this r mu, which are function of x mu. So now in four dimensions, one of them is r, and the other one is theta. Okay, so you get two ODEs, one for r and one for theta. These ODEs depend on the parameters of the solution, but they also depend on this mu, and they depend on the omega, on the frequency of the wave. So now what we were doing when reproducing these pictures, we were treating these ODEs as eigenvalue problem for omega and mu. Okay? And so we were actually plotting this mu here, but we have similar pictures for omega. And then you can look at, you know, what it corresponds to, what is the corresponding polarization, what is the corresponding overtune in radial direction, and so on.
But it's nothing to do with the decaying part of the frequency, I mean the imaginary part of the...
So what we naively assume is that this mu is probably something like imaginary, originally we thought so. And so it's almost imaginary, except so if omega is real, mu is also imaginary, probably, but doesn't matter. But if you go to complex, the other one is complex as well.
Sorry, so this is assuming fixed background, right? Like fixed baseline background.
Yeah, of course.
So
this is just...
So it's well known that for Kerr-Newman black holes, the gravitational and electromagnetic equation, these equations are not separable. So can you...
No. So these pictures are just for Kerr. Even in Kerr, these people couldn't do it. People couldn't separate massive Broca equations even in Kerr. So that's why we thought we just plot it for Kerr. More generally, this will be true for Kerr not ADS, but not with Maxwell field. No, I cannot couple it back to. Yeah, that would be too complicated, and it probably wouldn't work.
Lorentz condition. In fact, if you put in a curve, JA, and it doesn't necessarily follow that when you take the divergence, delta A, delta B, F, and B vanishes. And so you have a condition of J mu, D mu, G mu, D, D A, G A. You have to assume the right condition.
So, okay. So in Maxwell case, of course, the Lorentz, Lorentz condition is just whatever I can impose. Right here, it's a consequence of the equations, right?
What?
So here, the Lorentz condition is actually a consequence of the massive propagation. So
put in a code and take the divergence of both sides.
Yeah. Exactly. So if I put nabla b here, this will be 0, and that will meet the Lorentz condition.
Assume conservation of current, then
follow. Yeah. All right, so let me conclude. So there's this miracle. This is a summary of miracles properties of rotating black holes in any number of dimensions, and they all link to this principal tensor. And so I only talked about some. So I talked about the towers of hidden symmetries, and I talked about separability of scale Dirac and electromagnetic perturbations. I haven't talked about, I don't know, the stationary strings or the Weyl tensor or the Kerr-Shield form. I will talk a little bit in the afternoon. The huge question which remains is, of course, the separability of the gravitational perturbations. That's something which would be really nice to have. And I think, you know, this new ansatz of Lunin really gives hope that it may work, that maybe you can just, instead of a tensor BAB, you can put a tensor with three indices in front of a scalar function or something like that. But that will be a work under progress. So anyway, if you're interested to learn more, there's this review by myself and Valery Frolov and Pavel Kertosh. It's now published in Living Review. So here's the summary. So dynamical symmetries are genuine phase-space symmetries. And they play an interesting role in many areas of physics. So really, these hidden symmetries do exist, and people don't learn about them in the first course on Lagrangian mechanics, because they discuss everything on the configuration space, and so they basically prevent the symmetries of the phase space. So in GR, such dynamical symmetries are described by Killing tensors and Killing Yano tensors. And so out of them, the most interesting probably is the principal Killing Yano tensor. That plays this interesting role in black hole spacetimes. And so long-standing problem was really to look at separability of these higher spin equations, namely the electromagnetic and gravitational perturbations in these spacetimes. And so very, very recently, actually, people succeeded in doing this electromagnetic and Broca perturbations. But what remains is to do the gravitational perturbations. Well, thank you so much.
So the question came up about the per Newman, the charged black hole. Does this get around? I mean, as he said, people have not succeeded to separate those.
No.
Does this help, or has anyone tried with this?
I don't think it helps. Because then you have already a non-trivial electromagnetic background. So actually, if you perturb that non-trivial electromagnetic background, it gets much more complicated.
I mean, the other question is,
you could cheat. You could cheat. You could say, I have one background electromagnetic field, and now I study a different electromagnetic perturbation here, right? Then it would be simple, because then the Kerr-Newman solution has, in four dimensions, has exactly the same form as Kerr-Nott-ADS metric. So you could sort of do it, but you would have to pretend that what you are doing is you're perturbing a different field.
The second field was no back reaction.
Yeah. It wasn't. It's non-trivial background. Yeah. With trivial background.
Yes. Another question. I mean, you showed very nice how these have a very nice interpretation in phase space, even though they have no clearer or less clear interpretation in configuration in space time. Right. So, is there some analogous statement for the differential equations, like the Klein-Gordon equation and so on? In other words. Should you reformulate them in phase space somehow, everything becomes, you know?
That's a very good question. I don't know. Yeah, that would be very nice. I think that's what Loran was trying to do, right? To just look at the phase space formulation of this equation. But I don't know much about it. Yeah, but that would be interesting.
So if you were able to achieve number 5,
yep.
What calculations would you be able to do that we can't currently do?
Of course, you know, to study stability or quasi-normal modes and, you know, respect to these gravitational perturbations. So you know, what is interesting about these high-dimensional black holes is that they become unstable if they are rotating very fast, for example. So you are still within the class of Kernot RDS solutions, but if you switch on very, very high rotation, these are expected to be unstable, and they have been shown numerically to be unstable. But again, it's very, very complicated calculations. So if you separated these equations, then you can do it probably much more reliably and much more, you know, much faster and much more control over the result, let's say.
So you could do stability. Would it help with doing higher order perturbation theory, XOR?
Like the full nonlinear perturbation theory, do you mean? Or
just one order beyond linear?
I'm not an expert, maybe. I don't know that. Yeah, if that would help.
Insight to the cell force around
a curved
black hole
model? That'd be interesting, maybe.
What was the question?
About cell force.
So, I don't know, maybe you should put this off until the formal end of the talk, but I'd like to see the exact definition of this harmonic piece.
Okay, I can, well, you know, just. Very simply, I can refer you to the review. Yeah, but yeah, I can show you.
But you're also talking more about this later today, right?
Yeah, obviously.
Was it this later today?
The 3:30.
3:30. But just okay. So this is the big picture, grand results. I will talk about some small results in the afternoon, just blackboard.
Yeah, 3:30 analysis in the strong gravity group meeting.
Okay, so that's time.